the logo of Warner Brothers Pictures, a 1950s black Bakelite telephone. Alfred Hitchcock's Dial M for Murder. Color by Warner Color. Starring Ray Milland, Grace Kelly, Robert Cummings, with John Williams, Anthony Dawson, and Leo Britt, Patrick Allen, George Lee, George Alderson, Robin Hughes. A Warner Brothers First National Picture. Screenplay by Frederick Knott, as adapted from his play. Music composed and directed by Dmitri Tiomkin. Directed by Alfred Hitchcock. A policeman ambles slowly along a pavement in London. He stops for a moment, hands behind his back, and surveys the quiet residential street. He moves on. A couple pass by on the pavement. Inside one of the houses, a dark-haired man kisses a pretty blonde woman who is sitting at the breakfast table. She smiles and returns to her newspaper. Sitting to open his post, the man knocks over the salt and pepper pots. Irritably, he stands them upright and throws a pinch of salt over his shoulder. The woman reads an article in the newspaper. Among the passengers aboard the Queen Mary arriving in Southampton today is the American mystery writer Mark Halliday. The Queen Mary approaches Southampton. The huge liner towers over the quay. As the passengers disembark, a smartly dressed man wearing a trilby and carrying a raincoat over his arm looks around him and smiles. Later, in a sitting room, he embraces the blonde woman, kissing her passionately. She is now wearing a red cocktail dress. She pulls away and crosses the room.
Let me get you another drink. Mark, before Tony comes, I ought to explain something.
Yes, I've been waiting for that.
I haven't told him anything about us.
Well, that's not surprising. It's a tough thing to do.
When you telephoned this morning, I simply said you wrote crime stories and I'd met you once when you were here before.
That has a pretty guilty ring to it. I'd never use it in one of my stories.
Mark, I know you think it's silly, but when you get to know Tony, you'll understand why I said that.
Darling, I understand now, but that doesn't stop me from loving you.
It's not as simple as that.
She hands Mark a glass of whiskey and sits down.
Tony's changed.
Thanks.
He's a completely different person to the one I used to tell you about.
Really? When all this happened?
That night I came to say goodbye. When I left your apartment, I came back here. I sat down on the sofa and had a good cry, and then I fell asleep. And when I woke up, there was Tony standing in the hall with all his bags and tennis rackets. He just said he decided to give up tennis and settle down to a job.
Just like that?
Just like that. Of course, I didn't believe him at first, but he meant it all right. But he's been wonderful ever since.
I suppose that's when you stop writing me. Margot, is it?
Do you remember the letters you wrote to me?
Yes, I remember.
After I read them, I burnt them. I thought it best. All except one. You probably know the one I mean.
Yes, I think I do. What about it?
It was stolen.
Agitated, she gets up and moves away.
One day, Tony and I were going to spend the weekend in the country with friends, and while we were waiting on the platform, I noticed my handbag was missing, and the letter was inside.
Where was this?
Victoria Station. I thought at first I'd left it in the restaurant, but when I went back to look for it, it had gone.
You mean you never found it?
I recovered the handbag about 2 weeks later from the lost and found, but the letter wasn't there.
She sits.
And then about a week afterwards, I received a note. It told me what I had to do to get the letter back.
Yes, go ahead, go on.
I was to draw £50 from my bank in £5 notes, and then change them for used £1 notes. It said that if I went to the police or told anyone else, he would show the letter to my husband.
You still have the note?
Margot gets up and goes into the next room. She opens a drawer and takes something from it. Margot returns carrying two envelopes and hands one of them to Mark. He puts down his drink. Opening the envelope, he takes out a letter and reads it.
printed, all capitals. Anyone could have done this.
And 2 days later, I got this one.
Both mailed in Brixton.
Margot picks up her drink as Mark unfolds the second letter.
Tie up the money in a package and mail to John S. King, 23 Newport Street, Brixton, SW9. You'll get your letter by return.
It's a little shop. People use it as a forwarding address.
You didn't mail the money.
Yes.
Mark.
But the letter was never returned. So after waiting about 2 weeks, I went there. They said they'd never heard of a man by that name. And the parcel was still there. It had never been opened.
Well, that's something, I suppose. May I keep these?
Yes, if you like.
I can't understand why you didn't tell me about this.
Well, there wasn't anything you could do. You probably would have made me tell Tony and the police, and as it was only £50, I thought I'd pay up and have done with it.
Margot, I'm going to tell Tony about us tonight.
No, Mark, please, you mustn't. You don't understand. Tony's changed. Please.
I wish it was a year ago when you came to say goodbye. We were standing in the kitchen. I nearly turned around and said, I can't go through with this. Let's find Tony and tell him all about it. I believe you'd have done it then. Well, I can see this is going to be a rough evening. All of us saying nice things to each other. Look, there's only one thing you haven't explained. Why didn't you burn that letter, too?
She looks at him with longing, then moves into his arms. They kiss. They spring apart guiltily and look towards the front door of the flat. Her husband comes in.
Oh, there you are. We thought you were never coming. What have you been up to?
Oh, I'm sorry, Dom, but the boss blew in just as I was leaving.
Tony, this is Mark Halliday.
Hello,
Tony.
Mark.
Hello.
I'm terribly sorry to be so late.
He pours a drink.
Well, how do you like it over here, Mark?
Oh, fine, just fine, Tony.
Is this your first visit to London?
No, I was here a year ago for a vacation.
Oh, yes, that's right. Margot told me. You write for the radio, don't you?
No, television, for my sins.
Darling, did you reserve a table?
Yes, 7:00.
Well, come on then, get your...
Oh, darling, a slight alteration in plans.
Oh, now, don't say you can't go.
I'm afraid so. Old man Burgess is flying to Brussels on Sunday, and I have to get my monthly report in by tomorrow.
Well, can't you do it when we get back tonight?
I'm afraid not. It'll take hours. I still have to fake half of it as it is.
But, well, could you join us after the theater? We might go somewhere.
Why don't you give me a ring in intermission? If I'm inspired, I might make it.
Well, do try. Oh. I'll just get my things, Mark.
Oh, here are the tickets. Oh, thanks, Tony.
I'm afraid this is terribly rude of me.
Well, not at all. I'm just sorry you can't come along, though.
You must come to dinner one night.
Thanks, I'd like that.
By the way, what are you doing tomorrow night?
Saturday? Nothing I know of.
Well, how'd you like to come to a stag party?
A stag party?
Yes, some American boys have been playing tennis all over the continent, and we're giving them a sort of farewell dinner.
Oh, I see. Well, I'm not much of a tennis player.
Oh, that doesn't matter. You know New York and all that. Darling, Mark's coming to the party tomorrow night.
Oh, good. Well, you better drop in here first and have a drink.
That's the idea.
Yes. Yes. All right. Well, I'll try and get a taxi.
Oh, no, we can usually pick one up. So long, darling.
Enjoy yourself.
So long, Tony.
Good night.
Tony calls after them.
Oh, Mark.
Yes?
Try and sell the extra ticket and have a drink in the proceeds.
All right, Tony, we'll try.
Have a good time.
Thanks, night.
Closing the door of the flat, Tony looks around thoughtfully. He puts down his drink. He closes the curtains. He takes a piece of paper from his pocket and switches on the lamp. Sitting at the desk, he dials a number.
Hello, Hampstead 7899.
Yes.
Could I speak to Captain Lesgut, please?
Speaking.
Oh, good evening. You don't know me. My name is Fisher. I understand you have a car for sale. Yes, I saw it at your garage. How much are you asking?
$1,100.
$1,100, I see. Well, it certainly looks just a job for me, but I don't like that price much.
Well, I didn't like it when I bought it.
Now, when can we meet?
Tomorrow afternoon.
I'm afraid I can't manage that. No, I can't. And I'm going to Liverpool on Sunday. I was rather hoping... I say, you couldn't come round to my flat tonight.
Where is it?
Maid of Vale. I'd call on you, only I've twisted my knee rather badly.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, what's your address?
61A, Charrington Gardens.
Charrington?
Charrington.
Oh, Charrington.
Turn left to the underground. It's about a 2 minutes walk.
Right. I'll be there about an hour.
Oh, that's extremely good of you. Oh, by the way, will you bring in the car?
Oh, I'm afraid I can't.
Well, that doesn't matter. I had a good look at it. As you might bring the registration book and any necessary papers.
Yes, of course.
I don't see why we couldn't settle this whole thing here and now, provided you drop the price sufficiently.
Oh, I'm afraid that's quite out of the question.
Well, we'll see what a couple of drinks can do. Well, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Tony replaces the receiver. Walking purposefully across the room, he picks up a brown paper bag. He takes out a pair of white gloves, unfolds them, and places them neatly on the back of the sofa. Later, he takes a walking stick from beside the door, leans on it briefly, then places it across the end of a table. Hearing the outer door, he picks up the stick and leans on it. He opens the door of the flat.
Mr. Fisher?
Yes, Captain Lesgett?
Yes.
Won't you come in?
Thank you.
It's very good of you. Let me have your coat.
The visitor removes his overcoat.
Have any difficulty finding your way?
No, none at all.
Well, do sit down. How about a drink?
You know, I can't help thinking I've seen you before somewhere.
You know, it's funny you should mention that. The moment I opened the door, I... Wait a minute. Lesgett? You're not Lesgett. Swan, C.J. Swan, or was it C.A.?
C.A.? Well, you've got a better memory than I have. Fisher. When did we meet?
Weren't you at Cambridge?
Yes.
Must be 20 years ago. You wouldn't remember me. I only came here last year.
Well, what a coincidence.
Yes, it's called for a special drink. I was planning to palm you off in an indifferent port, but let's see what we have here. How about this?
Perfect.
Tony pours two brandies.
By the way, how do you know my car's for sale?
Your garage told me.
That's odd. I don't think I mentioned it to anyone there.
I was stopping for a fill-up, and I told them I was looking for an American car, and they gave me your phone number. I say, it is for sale, isn't it?
Well, of course.
Good, but I refuse to discuss the price until you've had at least three brandies.
Well, I warn you, I drive a hard bargain, drunk or sober.
So do I.
They both sit.
You know, I think I must have seen you somewhere since we left Cambridge.
Ever been to Wimbledon?
That's it. Wendis. Tony Wendis. What's all this about Fisher?
What's all this about Lesgett? Do you like a cigar?
No, thanks. I'll just stick to my pipe, if you don't mind.
Well, there's one habit you've changed. Oh? I remember at college you always used to smoke rather expensive cigars. Wait a minute. I think I have a picture of you here somewhere. Yes.
He takes down a photograph.
Yes, here's one. Taken at a reunion dinner. There you are, with the biggest cigar in the business.
Well, that's the first and last reunion I ever went to. What a murderous thug I look.
Yes, you do, rather. Of course, I always remember you because of the college ball. You were the treasurer, weren't you?
Honorary treasurer. Oh. I used to organize the beastly things.
Yes, some of the ticket money was stolen, wasn't it?
That's right, almost £100. I'd left it in a cash box in my study, and in the morning it had gone.
It was the college porter, of course.
Yes, of course. Poor old Alfred. He never could back a winner. Yeah, they found the cash box in his back garden.
But not the money.
20 years ago.
What are you doing nowadays?
I deal in property. I say, I don't follow tennis very closely. Do you still play?
No, I've given up tennis, or rather tennis gave me up. One has to earn a living sometime, and I had a pretty good run for my money. Went round the world 3 times.
What are you doing now?
I sell sports equipment. Not very lucrative, but it gives me plenty of spare time.
Well, I see you managed to run a very comfortable little place.
My wife has some money of her own. Otherwise, I should hardly feel like blowing £1,000 in your car.
£1,100. You know, people with capital don't realize how lucky they are. I'm almost resigned to living on what I can earn.
Well, you can always marry for money.
Yes, I suppose some people make a business out of that.
I know I did.
Why do you think she married you?
Well, I was a tennis star.
Yes, but you've given up tennis. She hasn't left you.
She nearly did. But after we were married, I played in the various championships and took Margot with me. She didn't like it much, and when we got back, she tried to make me give up tennis and play husband instead. In the end, we compromised. I went alone to America for the grass court season and returned after the national championships. I soon realized that a lot had happened while I was away. For one thing, she wasn't in love with me anymore. There were phone calls which would end abruptly if I happened to walk in. There was an old school friend she used to visit from time to time. One day we had a row. I wanted to play in a covered court tournament, and as usual, she didn't want me to go. I was in the bedroom. The phone rang. It all sounded pretty urgent. After that, she seemed rather keen that I'd play in the tournament after all, so I packed my kit into the car and drove off. I parked the car 2 streets away, walked back on my tracks. 10 minutes later, she came out of this house and took a taxi. I took another. Her old school friend lived in a studio in Chelsea. I could see them through the studio window as he cooked spaghetti over a gas ring. They didn't say much. They just looked very natural together. You know, it's funny how you can tell when people are in love. I went for a walk. Began to wonder what would happen if she left me. I have to find some way of earning a living to begin with. I suddenly realized how much I'd grown to depend on her. All these expensive tastes I'd acquired while I was at the top. Now, big tennis had finished with me, and so apparently had my wife. I can't ever remember being so scared. I dropped into a pub and had a couple of drinks. As I sat in the corner, I thought of all sorts of things. I thought of three different ways of killing him. I even thought of killing her. And that seemed a far more sensible idea. And just as I was working out how I could do it, I suddenly saw something which completely changed my mind.
Swan looks intrigued.
I didn't go to that tournament after all. When I got back, she was sitting exactly where you are now. And I told her I decided to give up tennis and look after her instead.
Well?
Well, as things turned out, I needn't got so worked up after all. Apparently that spaghetti evening had been a sort of a fond farewell. The boyfriend had been called back to New York.
Oh, an American?
Yes. There were long letters from there. They usually arrived on Thursdays. And she burned them all except one. That one she used to transfer from handbag to handbag. It was always with her. That letter became an obsession with me. I had to find out what was in it. And finally I did. That letter made very interesting reading.
Do you mean you stole it?
Yes. I even wrote her two anonymous notes offering to sell it back.
Why?
I was hoping you would make her come and tell me all about him. But it didn't. So I kept the letter.
An airmail envelope drops from his pocketbook.
Why are you telling me all this?
Because you're the only person I can trust.
Swan picks up the envelope, looks at it, and hands it back.
Anyway, that did it. It must have put the fear of God into them because the letter stopped. And we lived happily ever after. You know, it's funny to think that just a year ago, I sat in that Knightsbridge pub actually planning to murder her. And I might have done it. If I hadn't seen something that changed my mind.
Well, what did you see?
I saw you.
Swan looks at him warily.
What was so odd about that?
The coincidence. You see, only a week before, I'd been to a reunion dinner, and the fellows were talking about you. How you'd been court-martialed during the war. A year in prison. That was news. Mind you, at college, we'd all said that old Swan would end up in jail. That cash box, I suppose.
Well, what about it?
Oh, my dear fellow, everybody knew you took that money. Poor old Alfred.
Swan empties his glass and gets up.
Thanks very much for the drink. Interesting hearing about your matrimonial affairs. I take it you won't be wanting that car after all.
Don't you want me to tell you why I brought you here?
Yes, I think you'd better.
It was when I saw you in that pub that it happened. Suddenly everything became quite clear.
Tony wipes the photograph with his handkerchief.
Only a few months before, Margot and I had made our wills, quite short affairs, leaving everything we had to each other in case of accidents. Hers worked out at just over £90,000. Investments, mostly. All a little too easy to get at. And that was dangerous, as they'd be bound to suspect me. I need an alibi. A very good one. Then I saw you. I'd often wondered what happened to people when they came out of prison. People like you, I mean. Can they get jobs? Do old friends rally round? Suppose they'd never had any friends. I became so curious to know that I followed you. I followed you home that night. And would you mind passing me your glass, old boy?
Tony wipes the glass.
Thank you very much. And I've been following you ever since.
Why?
I was hoping that sooner or later I might catch you with something and be able to,
blackmail me?
Influence you. After a couple of weeks, I got to know your routine, and that made it a lot easier.
Rather dull work.
To begin with, yes. But you know how it is. You take up a hobby, and the more you get to know it, the more fascinating it becomes. You became quite fascinating. In fact, there were times when I felt that you almost belonged to me.
That must have been interesting.
You used to go to the dog racing Mondays and Thursdays. I even took it up myself, just to be near you. You'd change your name to Adams.
Yes, I got bored with Swan. Any crime in that?
No, none whatever. In fact, there was nothing really illegal about you. I got quite discouraged. Then one day you disappeared from your lodgings. I phoned your landlady. I said, Mr. Adams owed me £5. Well, apparently that was nothing. Mr. Adams owed her 6 weeks' rent and her best lodger £55. And Mr. Adams had been such a nice gentleman. That's what seemed to upset her most.
Yes. That always seems to upset them most.
I say, old boy, if you want another drink, do you mind putting on these gloves? Now, where were we? Oh, yes, I'd lost you, and then I found you one day at the dog racing. And I tailed you home to your new lodgings in Belsize Park. There, Mr. Adams became Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson left Belsize Park, owing 16 weeks' rent, and somewhat richer for a brief encounter with a Miss Wallace. You used to take Miss Wallace out on Wednesdays and Sundays. She certainly was in love with you, wasn't she? I suppose she thought you were growing that handsome moustache to please her. Poor Miss Wallace.
This is all very interesting. Do go on.
July, August, September. Apartment 127, Carlisle Court. Occupant of Mrs. Van Dorn. Her late husband left her two hotels and a large apartment house furnished. What a base to operate from, Captain Lesgate. The only trouble is, she does rather enjoy being courted, and she's so very expensive. Perhaps that's why I've been trying to sell her car for over a month.
Mrs. Van Dorn asked me to sell it for her.
I know. I called her up just before you arrived here. She only wanted 800.
Swan paces a few steps.
Where's the nearest police station?
Opposite the church, 2 minutes' walk.
Suppose I walk there now.
What would you tell them?
Everything.
Everything? All about Mr. Adams and Mr. Wilson?
I should simply tell them that you're trying to blackmail me into...
Into?
Murdering your wife.
I almost wish you would. When she heard that, we'd have the biggest laugh of our lives.
Aren't you forgetting something?
Am I?
You've told me quite a lot tonight.
What of it?
Suppose I tell them how you followed her to that studio in Chelsea and watched them cooking spaghetti and all that rubbish. Wouldn't that ring a bell?
Oh, it certainly would. They'd assume you followed her there yourself.
Me? Why should I?
Why should you steal her handbag? Why should you write her all those blackmail notes? Can you prove you didn't? You certainly can't prove I did. It'll be a straight case of your word against mine.
That'd puzzle them, wouldn't it? What could you say?
I should simply say that you came here tonight half drunk and tried to borrow money on the strength that we were at college together. When I refused, you mentioned something about a letter belonging to my wife. As far as I could make out, you're trying to sell it to me. I gave you what money I had, and you gave me the letter. It has your fingerprints on it, remember?
Tony shows him the letter in his pocketbook.
Then you said if I went to the police, you'd tell some crazy story about my wanting you to murder my wife. But before you go any further, old boy, do consider the inconvenience. You see, I'm quite well known, and there'd be pictures of you as well. And sooner or later, there'd be a deputation of landladies and lodgers who would step forward to testify to your character. And someone is almost certain to have seen you with Miss Wallace. You were careful not to be seen around with her, I noticed. You usually met in out-of-the-way places where you wouldn't be recognized. Like the little tea shop in Pimlico.
That was her idea, not mine.
Yes, it was a bit crummy, wasn't it? Hardly the place to take Mrs. Van Dorn. By the way, does Mrs. Van Dorn know about Mr. Adams and Mr. Wilson and Miss Wallace? You were planning to marry Mrs. Van Dorn, weren't you?
Smart, aren't you?
No, not really. I've just had time to think things out, put myself in your position. That's why I know you're going to agree.
What makes you think I'll agree?
For the same reason that a donkey with a stick behind him and a carrot in front always goes forwards and not backwards.
Tell me about the carrot.
£1,000 in cash.
For a murder?
For a few minutes' work, that's all it is. And no risk, I guarantee. That ought to appeal to you. You've been skating on pretty thin ice.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You ought to know. It was in all the papers. Middle-aged woman found dead due to an overdose of something. Apparently, she'd been taking the stuff for quite some time, and nobody knows where she got it. But we know, don't we? Poor Miss Wallace.
Swan looks thoughtful.
£1,000. Where is it?
It's in a small attaché case in a check room.
Where?
Somewhere in London. Of course, we don't meet again. As soon as you've delivered the goods, I shall mail you the check room ticket and the key to the case. Take this £100 on account.
He throws a bundle of banknotes onto an armchair.
You know, the police would only have to trace one of these notes back to you to hang us both from the same rope.
They won't. For a whole year, I've been cashing an extra £20 a week, always in fivers. I then change them for those at my leisure.
Let me see your bank statement.
By all means.
Tony takes a folder from a drawer and places it on the desk.
Don't touch.
Tony opens the folder.
Turn back a page. Ah, your balance has dropped by over £1,000 during the year. Suppose the police ask you about that.
I go dog racing twice a week.
They'll check your bookmaker.
Like you, I always bet on the tote. Satisfied?
When would this take place?
Tomorrow night.
Tomorrow? Not a chance. I've got to think this over.
It has to be tomorrow. I've arranged things that way.
Where?
Approximately where you're standing now.
How?
Tomorrow evening, Halliday, that's the American boyfriend, and I will go out to a stag party. She'll stay here. She'll go to bed early and listen to Saturday Night Theater on the radio. She always does when I'm out. At exactly 3 minutes to 11, you'll enter the house with the street door. You'll find the key to this door.
He opens the door and steps into the hall.
Under the stair carpet here.
The fifth step.
That's the one. Go straight to the window. Hide behind the curtains. At exactly 11 o'clock, I shall go to the telephone in the hotel to call my boss. I shall dial the wrong number. This number. That's all I shall do. When the phone rings, you'll see the light go on under her bedroom door. When she opens it, the light will stream across the room. So don't move until she answers the phone. There must be as little noise as possible. After you've finished, pick up the phone and give me a soft whistle. Then hang up. Don't speak whatever you do. I shan't say a word. When I hear your whistle, I shall hang up and redial. The correct number this time. I shall then talk to my boss as if nothing had happened and return to the party.
Well, what happens next? Go on.
You'll see the suitcase here. It contains some clothes of mine for the cleaners. Open it and tip the clothes out onto the floor. Then fill it with a cigarette box and some of these cups. Close the lid, but don't snap the locks. Then leave the suitcase there just as it is now.
Oh, as if I'd left in a hurry.
That's the idea. Now the window. If it's locked, unlock it and leave it open. Then go out exactly the same way you came in.
By this door?
Yes. And here's the most important thing. As you go out, return the key to the place where you found it.
Under the stair carpet?
Yes.
Yes, but what exactly is supposed to have happened?
Well, they'll assume you came in by the window. You thought the apartment was empty, so you took the suitcase and went to work. She heard something. She switched on her light. You saw the light under the door and hid behind the curtains. When she came in here, you attacked her before she could scream. When you realized you'd actually killed her, you panicked, bolted through the garden, and left the loot behind you.
Just a minute. I'm supposed to have come in through these windows. Suppose they'd been locked.
It wouldn't matter. You see, she often takes a walk around the garden before she goes to bed, and she usually forgets to lock up when she gets back. That's what I shall tell the police.
Yes, but she may say that.
But she isn't going to say anything. Is she?
All right. I leave the apartment. I put the key back under the stair carpet and go out by the street door. Suppose the street door's locked. How do I get in the first place?
The street door is never locked.
What time will you get back?
About 12. I'll bring Halliday back for a nightcap so we'll find her together. And we shall have been together since we left her. And there's my alibi.
Swan slowly crosses to the door and opens it. He peers out into the hall. He closes the door and turns to Tony.
You've forgotten something.
What?
When you get back with what's-his-name, Halliday, how will you get into the apartment?
I shall let myself in.
But your key will be under the stair carpet. He'll see you getting it out. It'll get the whole show away.
No, it won't be my key under the carpet. It'll be hers. I shall take it from her handbag and hide it out there just before I leave the flat. She's not going out, so she won't miss it. When I come back with Halliday, I'll use my own key to let us in. Then, while he's out searching the garden or something, I'll take the key from under the carpet and return it to her handbag before the police arrive.
How many keys are there to this door?
Just hers and mine.
Tony crosses to the desk.
Maydeville 3499.
Terry, it's me.
Oh, hello, darling. How's it going?
Wonderfully. It's really a dreadful plague. We're enjoying every minute.
No, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm glad.
You will join us, won't you?
Well, I don't think so. I hardly seem to have started. Oh, darling, just a moment. I think there's someone at the door.
He warns Swan.
You can be seen from the bedroom window. Sorry, darling, false alarm. Look, why don't you take Mark to Jerry's?
How do we get in?
Oh, just mention my name. I don't know about the band, but the food's good. By the way, Maureen called up just after you left and wants us for dinner on Wednesday. But you've got something written in your diary for Wednesday, and I can't read your writing. Looks like Al Bentor. Who's he? Another one of your boyfriends?
Albert Hall, you idiot.
Oh, the Albert Hall, of course. I'm so glad we don't have to go to Maureen. She's such a filthy cook.
I must fly.
All right, dear. Enjoy yourself.
During the phone call, Swan has put on the gloves and turned off all the lights except for the one in the bedroom. Now he switches the lights on again. He crosses the room and turns off the bedroom light. He closes the bedroom door. He takes off the gloves. Tony watches him closely as he drops the gloves onto the table. Swan looks at Tony, then takes a step towards the armchair. He picks up the bundle of money. Still holding Tony's gaze, Swan carefully tucks the notes into the inside pocket of his jacket. Evening. It's dark outside the French windows. Margot is showing Mark a scrapbook while Tony is mixing drinks. The men are wearing dinner jackets.
Tony, don't make that martini too watery. Oh, now, where's the picture of Mar Raja?
She searches through press cuttings.
Darling, when are you going to finish pasting in those clippings?
Oh, I shall find time one of these days. Achilles. This is the Mar Raja. Isn't he dreamy?
Yeah, four Rolls Royces and enough jewels to sink a battleship, but all he really wanted was to play at Wimbledon.
Oh, the poor darling, he was so short-sighted that he could barely see the end of the racket, let alone the ball.
You know, you should, you should write a book about all this.
Why don't you two collaborate? A detective novel with a tennis background.
Yes, what about it, Mark? You provide me with the perfect murder.
Nothing I'd like better.
How do you go about writing a detective story?
Well, you forget detection and concentrate on crime. Crime's the thing. And then you imagine you're going to steal something or murder somebody.
Oh, is that how you do it? It's interesting.
Yes, I usually put myself in the criminal's shoes, and then I keep asking myself, what do I do next?
Do you really believe in the perfect murder?
Yes, absolutely. On paper, that is. And I think I could plan one better than most people, but I doubt if I could carry it out.
Oh? Why not?
Well, because in stories, things usually turn out the way the author wants them to, and in real life, they don't. Always. No, I'm afraid my murders would be something like my bridge. I'd make some stupid mistake and never realize until I found everybody was looking at me.
You better drink up, Mark.
Yes.
What are you doing tomorrow?
Nothing I know of.
Why don't we all drive down to Windsor for lunch?
That's a good idea. Come along early, but not too early. We may be nursing a hangover.
How about 11?
Fine.
Oh, we can have lunch at the King's Head.
Is that right in Windsor?
No, it's just outside.
Oh.
Darling, did I lend you my latchkey? I can't seem to find it anywhere.
I don't know. I may have them both in my handbag. I'll just look.
She goes into the bedroom. As Mark puts on his coat, Tony crosses to the French windows and looks out into the dark garden. Then he closes the long velvet curtains. Margot returns with her handbag.
No, I've only got one here. Are you sure yours isn't in your overcoat?
No, I've looked. May I borrow yours?
Well, that's a bit awkward.
Why?
I may want to go out.
Tonight?
Yes, I thought I might go to a movie or something.
Well, aren't you going to listen to the radio? Saturday Night Theatre?
Oh, no, it's a thriller. I don't like thrillers when I'm alone.
I see.
Well, in any case, I'll be back before you so I can let you in.
But we won't be back until after midnight. You may be asleep by then.
You can always put your key under the proverbial mat.
Oh, it's all right. Here it is. It was in my glove all the time.
Well, that settles that.
What movie are you going to?
Oh, the classic, I expect.
Will you get in? Saturday night?
Oh, I can always try.
Oh, but darling.
Oh, now, don't make me stay home. You know how I hate doing nothing.
Doing nothing? Why, there are hundreds of things you can do. It'll be written to Peggy, thanking her for the weekend. And what about those clippings? It's an ideal opportunity.
Well, I like that. You two go gallivanting while I stay home and do those boring clippings.
Very well. We won't go.
What do you mean?
Well, it's quite obvious you don't want us to go out tonight, so we won't. We'll stay here with you instead. What should we do, play cards?
Oh, Tony, darling.
Well, I'd better call the Grand and tell him we're not coming.
Oh, Tony, please, don't be childish about this. All right, I'll do your old press clippings.
You don't have to if you don't want to, you know.
But I do want to.
Tony closes the second pair of curtains.
I think I'll try and scare up a taxi.
Have we any paste?
Yes, there's some in the desk, I believe. You need some scissors.
Oh, they're in my mending basket.
Tony crosses the room and picks up the mending basket. He places it on a small table. Opening the basket, he finds the scissors under a pair of stockings. He walks to the desk and hands the scissors to Margot. Then, without her seeing, opens her handbag and takes the key from her purse.
Lend me some change, dear. I just need some money for the taxi.
Hey, you leave my bag alone. How much do you need, anyway?
Well, let's see how much you've got.
Put that.
You owe me 10 bob, anyway.
Well, what?
I paid that package you sent to Peggy. That comes out of housekeeping.
Well, let me give it to you, then I keep your hands out. There now. How much do you want?
Well, I've got 3, 5, 7, and 6 pence. It'll all be enough to get us there and back.
Oh, but you better take something. How much are the dinner tickets?
Already paid for, tipping included. If I run short, Mark will help out.
He goes to the door.
Taxi's here.
Mark is standing in front of the stairs. Tony clutches the key uncertainly.
Tony, what are you waiting for?
Oh, nothing, dear, nothing. Night, Mark.
Night, Mark. What time will you get home?
Oh, about 12, I should think. I'll bring Mark back for a nightcap on his way home. Will you be up?
I should be fast asleep, and I don't want to be disturbed.
We should be as quiet as mice. Night.
Night.
Tony stops and goes back.
Margot!
He leans casually on the fifth step.
You know, it's quite possible old man Burgess might call. Would you tell him we're at the Grand? It might be rather important.
What's the number?
It's in the book.
All right.
Tony kisses Margot and touches her cheek.
Goodbye, dear.
The men leave.
All right, Mark.
The key to the flat is just visible. Under the carpet on the fifth stair. Lamplight is reflected on wet pavements. A figure in a raincoat appears, walking briskly. It is Swan. He slows down as he approaches the house. He stops and looks at his watch by the light of a street lamp. 7 minutes to 11. Inside the flat, Margot is sound asleep in bed. Swan quietly opens the street door and lets himself into the house. He walks stealthily along the hall to the stairs and locates the fifth step from the bottom. Still wearing his gloves, he takes the key from under the stair carpet and silently unlocks the door to the flat. Margot sleeps on undisturbed as the door slowly opens and Swan peers inside. He closes the door behind him and looks around the shadowy room. Swan steps towards the fireplace and looks down at the fire, which is still alight. He turns and makes his way carefully across the room by the light of the flickering flames. Swan glances at the telephone on the desk and then towards the closed bedroom door. He peers out into the garden, then looks at his watch again. 2 minutes to 11. Tying a knot in his scarf, he conceals himself behind the full-length velvet curtains which are drawn across the French windows. The stag party at the hotel. Tony looks at his watch. It says 20 to 11. Back at the flat, Swan peers from behind the curtain looking puzzled. He looks at his watch again and then at the silent telephone. At the party, Tony checks his watch again. It still says 20 to 11.
Excuse me a moment. Do any of you fellas have the right time?
Yes, I have
7 minutes past 11.
I make it only just after 11.
Well, my watch has stopped. I must have overwhelmed.
Sir, as I was saying,
excuse me, I have to call my boss.
Tony gets up quickly. At the flat, Swan emerges uncertainly from behind the curtains, still holding the scarf. He hesitates for a moment, then pushes the scarf into his pocket and walks slowly towards the door. In the hotel lobby, Tony heads for the telephone kiosk. To his dismay, he finds it occupied. Impatiently, he paces outside. At last, the elderly gentleman finishes his conversation. Tony hurries into the kiosk and lifts the receiver. He pushes his money into the box and dials. M. The connection is made at the telephone exchange. Swan is halfway out of the flat as a light goes on in the bedroom. Margot gets out of bed, half asleep, and opens the bedroom door. She goes into the sitting room wearing only a flimsy nightdress. Crossing to the desk, she picks up the receiver.
Hello? 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 Hello?
Swan steps from behind the curtains.
Hello?
At the hotel, Tony is listening intently.
Hello.
Swan puts the scarf around her neck and pulls it tight. He twists the scarf as Margot tries to fight him off. Swan forces her backwards until she is lying back across the desk. Tony listens silently as Margot gasps for breath. As Swan bends over her, she struggles frantically to push him away. She reaches back above her head. Her clutching fingers grasp the open scissors. She plunges them desperately into his back. Swan drops on top of her, the scissors embedded deep into him. Rearing up again, he lurches and staggers. The scarf still around her neck, Margot slips from the desk onto the floor. She looks away in horror as Swan collapses beside her, driving the scissors even further into his back. Struggling into a sitting position, Margot snatches up the receiver, which is dangling by its cord over the side of the desk.
Get the police! Quickly, police!
Tony presses button A.
Margot?
Who's that?
Darling, it's me.
Oh, Tony. Tony, thank God. Come back at once.
What's the matter? Darling, pull yourself together. What is it?
A man attacked me. He tried to strangle me.
Did he get away?
No, he's dead. He's dead.
Leaning heavily on the desk, she scrambles to her feet.
Tony, are you still there?
Margot?
Yes?
Now listen very carefully.
Yes,
don't touch anything. I'll be with you right away.
No, I won't.
Don't touch anything and don't speak to anybody till I get there.
No, I won't touch anything.
You promise?
Yes, I promise. Only please be quick.
Margot puts down the phone and, clutching her throat, staggers to the French windows. She throws them open and steps out into the fresh air of the garden. As she tries to recover herself, the scarf slips from her shoulder and drops unnoticed onto the ground. Still distraught, she goes back into the room. She catches sight of Swan's body lying on the floor. Margot stumbles across the room and into the bedroom. At the hotel, Tony returns to his companions.
I was sitting in the same bar, and I see the same man standing at the end of the thing, and he came across to me and said...
Sit down. I have to run along. It's Margot. She's not feeling too well.
Serious?
No, nothing serious. You stay and enjoy yourself.
I'll come along.
No, it's perfectly all right.
Mark anxiously watches him go. At the flat, Margot looks at her bruised throat in the bathroom mirror. Tony sits in the back of a taxi, his face grim. He hurries into the house and, glancing quickly upstairs, unlocks the door to the flat. Margot rushes into his arms.
Tony! Oh, Tony!
It's all right, darling. It's all right. What happened?
He pulled something around my throat. It felt like a stock.
Sure, let me see.
He looks at the marks on her neck.
I got up to answer the phone and he came from behind the curtain and turned his thing on.
Comforting her, he slips his front door key into his pocket, then glances at Margot's handbag. He pats her shoulder reassuringly, then kneels down beside Swan's lifeless body. Still shaken, Margot stands back as he turns the body over and looks at the wound made by the scissors. Tony starts to search the dead man's pockets. He turns to see Margot opening her handbag.
There's hardly any blood. When he fell, he must have... What are you doing?
I'm trying to find my... Oh, here they are, my aspirin. Got such an awful head.
Leaving her handbag open, she goes into the bathroom and gets a glass of water. Tony takes a key from one of Swan's pockets and puts it quickly into Margot's purse. She comes back into the sitting room.
What is it?
I'd better get a blanket.
Tony hurries past her into the bedroom. He returns with a blanket and carefully spreads it over the body, covering it completely. Watching him, Margot clasps her bare arms and shivers.
Shut the window, please.
No, he mustn't touch anything until the police arrive. Must have broken in. Wonder what he was after. Those cups, I expect.
When will the police get here?
Have you called them already?
No. You told me not to speak to anyone. Hadn't you better call them now?
Yes.
Where's Mark?
I told him to go straight home.
Operator.
Hello, operator. Get me the Maida Vale police, quickly.
Did you tell him?
No, I didn't know what had happened. I just said that you weren't feeling well.
Maida Vale police.
Oh, police, there's been a ghastly accident.
Yes, sir?
A man has been killed.
Your name, sir?
Wendis.
Is that a double S?
No, D-I-C-E.
See, your address, sir?
61A Charrington Gardens, ground floor apartment.
Was it an accident?
I don't know.
What do you mean, sir, you don't know? You think he might have been killed by someone?
Well, I don't know.
Well, have you any idea who might have done it?
Tony stares at Margot for a moment.
I'll explain that to you when you come. How long will it take?
About 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
And don't touch anything, will you, sir?
No, we won't touch anything. Goodbye.
I'll get dressed.
Why?
They'll want to see you.
They're not going to see you.
But they'll have to ask me questions.
They can wait until tomorrow. I'll tell them all they need to know.
Tony?
Yes?
Why did you phone me?
What? I'm sorry, darling. I'll tell you about that later. I just thought of something. You said he used a stocking.
I think it was a stocking or a scarf, isn't it there?
No, but I expect they'll find it. Now you go on to bed.
He kisses her cheek and ushers her into the bedroom, closing the door behind her. Tony quickly crosses the sitting room and looks carefully at the floor around the desk. Finding nothing, he glances back around the room. He goes to the open French windows, steps outside, and looks around the dark garden. Turning to go in again, he spots the scarf lying on the ground at his feet. He picks it up and walks back into the room, holding it thoughtfully in his hands. He spots Margot's mending basket and walks towards it. In front of the fireplace, Tony picks up a cigarette lighter from the coffee table, then changes his mind and puts the lighter down again. He takes a tin of lighter fuel from the mantelpiece, sprinkling the contents over the scarf, he throws it onto the glowing embers. He empties the tin of lighter fuel on top of it, feeding the flames. In the bedroom, Margot sits slumped on the bed. Tony puts the empty tin on the mantelpiece and watches as the flames lick around the scarf, destroying it completely. Then he opens the mending basket and takes out a pair of stockings. He knots one of them, goes out through the French windows, and drops it on the ground exactly where he found the scarf. He comes back into the room. Still holding the second stocking, he looks around for a moment, then lifts the corner of the leather blotter on top of the desk and carefully slips the stocking underneath. Now he uncovers the dead man's body. He kneels down and, using a handkerchief, takes the airmail envelope from his pocketbook and pushes it into the inside pocket of Swan's jacket. Then he covers him up again with the blanket. Getting to his feet, Tony walks to the fireplace and picks up a poker. He stirs the ashes in the grate. He replaces the poker. He sits in the armchair beside the fire, takes out his cigarette case, and calmly puts a cigarette in his mouth. Later, the police search for fingerprints and take photographs. An officer throws a rug over a bloodstain on the carpet. Tony carries in a tray.
Tea, gentlemen?
He puts the tray of teacups onto the desk. As he does so, he deliberately pushes the edge of the blotter with the tray so that the stocking is just visible. Tony picks up a cup of tea and carries it towards the bedroom.
Sergeant? Look, it's the other stocking.
All right, break it up. Let's get moving on.
Next morning, a policeman disperses the small crowd which has gathered outside the house. Inside the flat, Tony is in his shirt sleeves. Hands in his pockets, he crosses the room and peers at the ashes in the fireplace. As he picks up the fuel tin, Margot comes out of the bedroom wearing a plain woolen dress.
Almost empty. Remind me to get some more. Always runs out just when we need it. Oh, look, before I forget, the sergeant wanted to know why you didn't phone the police immediately.
How could I? You were on the telephone.
I know, but...
You distinctly told me not to speak to anyone until you got here.
I know, darling, but I told him a slightly different story.
Why?
Well, I said you didn't phone the police because you naturally assumed that I would do it from the hotel.
Why did you say that?
Because it was the perfectly logical explanation and he accepted it. Now, if they get the idea that we delayed reporting it, they might get nosy and start asking all sorts of questions.
So you want me to say the same thing?
I think so, dear, in case it comes up again. Oh, that'll be Mark. Would you let him in?
A smartly dressed man with a moustache removes his hat.
Good morning, madam.
Oh, good morning.
Mrs. Wendy's?
Yes.
I'm a police officer. May I come in?
Of course.
He steps inside and Margot closes the door.
Excuse me, I'll just tell my husband you're here.
Oh, thank you.
The man drops his hat over a walking stick in the umbrella stand. He puts his raincoat on a chair. He glances at the rug covering the bloodstain. Hands on hips, he surveys the flat. Then crossing to the desk, he rests his hand on the telephone and looks towards the French windows. Tony appears, now wearing his jacket.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir. I'm Chief Inspector Hubbard, in charge of criminal investigation of this division.
I think we gave your sergeant all the necessary information.
Yes, I've seen his report, of course, but there are a few things I'd like to get firsthand. I gather the sergeant only saw you for a few moments, Mrs. Wendy's.
Yes,
I... My wife was suffering from considerable shock.
Yes, that was a very nasty experience you had. Do you mind if I take a look around, sir?
Go ahead, the bedroom and bathroom are through here.
Hubbard follows Tony into the bedroom, glances around, then opens the bathroom door. He looks inside.
I certainly didn't get in by the bathroom.
Tony leads him out of the bedroom and crosses towards the kitchen.
The kitchen has bars on the window.
Tony opens the kitchen door and Hubbard peers inside.
We assume he must have come in through these windows here.
I understand that you weren't here when this happened, sir.
No, I was at a dinner party at the Grandin Hotel. And by curious coincidence, I was actually phoning my wife when she was attacked.
Yes, I gather. Can you tell me exactly what time it was, sir?
No, I'm afraid I can't. I do remember my watch had stopped.
Hubbard crosses to Margot.
Did you notice, Mrs. Wendy?
No, I didn't.
Won't you sit down, Inspector?
No, thank you.
Have you any idea who he was?
Yes, at least we've discovered where he lived. There still seems to be some confusion as to his real name.
Oh?
He appeared to have several. Had you ever seen him before?
Why, no, of course not.
He shows her some photographs.
Oh. Is this him?
Yes. You don't recognize?
No, I never saw him.
But didn't you even catch a glimpse of his face?
No, you see, he attacked me from behind and it was dark. I hardly saw him at all.
Yes, but before I showed you these photographs, you said you'd never seen him before. Now, how could you know that if you never saw his face last night?
I don't quite understand.
Inspector, my wife simply means that as far as she knew, she never saw him before.
Was that what you meant?
Yes.
Now, how about you, sir? Had you ever seen him before?
Tony looks at the photos.
No. No. At least...
Yes?
It's very like someone I was at college with. But the moustache makes quite a difference.
Oh, what was his name?
Oh, I don't know. It must be 20 years since I left.
Was it, Lesgett?
No.
Wilson?
No.
Swan?
Swan. Wait a minute. Swan, yes, that's it.
He takes the photograph from the wall.
Here's an old photo taken at a reunion. We were at the same college together. There he is there. Why, it's unbelievable.
Did you know him well?
No, he was senior to me.
Now, have you met him since then?
No. At least, come to think of it, I did see him quite recently, but not to speak to.
Oh, when was that?
Oh, about 6 months ago at a railway station, Victoria, I think. I remember noticing how little he'd changed.
Now, had he a moustache then, sir?
No.
Mrs. Winters, would you show me exactly what happened last night?
Tony, do I have to?
I'm afraid so, darling.
Margot gets up and indicates the bedroom.
I was in bed when the phone rang, and I got up and I came in here.
Did you switch this light on?
No.
Just show me exactly where you were standing.
She crosses the room and stands behind the desk.
I stood here, and I picked up the phone.
Just one moment. Are you sure you had your back to the window like that?
Yes.
But why?
Why not?
I mean, why go round the desk? I should have picked it up from this side.
But I always answer the phone from here.
But why?
Well, in case I have to write anything down, I could hold the phone in my left hand.
I see. I'm sorry. Go on.
Well, I picked up the phone. He must have come from behind those curtains and attacked me. He got something round my neck.
Something? What do you mean by something?
I think it was a stocking.
I see. Now, what happened then?
Well, then he pushed me across the desk. I distinctly remember feeling for the scissors.
Now, where were those scissors usually kept?
In that mending basket. I'd forgotten to put them away.
Now, what makes you think he came from behind those curtains?
Where else could he have been?
The curtains were drawn, I suppose.
Yes, they were.
Did you draw them yourself?
No, Inspector. I drew them just before I went out.
Did you lock the window at the same time?
Yes.
Are you quite sure of that, sir?
Oh, perfectly sure. I always lock up and I draw the curtain.
Then how do you suppose he got into this room?
Well, we assume that he broke in.
Well, there's no sign of a break-in. Our report shows the lock's quite undamaged. Mrs. Winters, why didn't you call the police immediately this happened?
Behind the inspector, Tony gives her a warning look.
I was trying to get through to the police when I discovered my husband was on the line. I naturally thought that he would call the police from the hotel before he came here.
Didn't it occur to you to call a doctor?
No.
Why ever not?
He was dead.
How did you know that?
It was obvious.
Did you feel his pulse?
No, of course I didn't. Anyone would have realized he was dead. Just one look at those staring eyes.
Oh, so you did see his face after all.
I saw his eyes. I can't remember his face.
Inspector, my wife obviously had never seen this man before. And if he didn't come in by those windows, how did he get in?
Hubbard opens the flat door.
As a matter of fact, we're quite certain that he came in by this door.
But it was locked.
Margot, did you open that door at all after we'd gone?
No.
Well, how many keys are there to this door, sir?
Only two. Mine was in my handbag and you had yours with you.
Yes, that's right.
Has the caretaker got a key?
No.
Do you employ a charwoman?
Yes, but she hasn't got one either. I'm always here when she comes.
What makes you think he came in this way?
His shoes.
His shoes?
The ground was soaking wet last night. And if he'd come in by the garden, he'd have left mud all over the carpet. As it is, he didn't leave any marks at all, because he wiped his shoes on the front door mat.
How can you tell?
It's a fairly new mat, and some of its fibres came off on his shoes.
Oh, but surely...
And there was a small tar stain on the mat, and some of the fibres show that as well. Now, there's no question about it.
Wait a minute. I think I've got it. You remember when your bag was stolen?
Yes.
Wasn't the key inside?
Yes, but it was still there when I got it back.
Now, just a moment. I mean, I'd like to hear about this. What sort of bag?
A handbag, Inspector. My wife lost it at Victoria Station.
But I got it back from the lost and found about 2 weeks later.
Now, was anything missing?
All the money was gone.
Anything else?
No.
I mean, no papers or letters?
No.
Are you quite sure about that?
Yes.
And your latchkey was in your handbag when you lost it?
Yes, but it was still there when it was returned.
Well, whoever stole the money could have copied the key.
Where was the bag found, eventually?
At Victoria Station.
Wasn't that where you said you saw this man, sir?
When did you lose the bag? Wasn't it that weekend we went to visit Peggy? Yes, it was. I remember now. He was sitting in the restaurant.
Was that where you left your handbag?
Yes, it was. And didn't I say something about, oh, there's someone I was at college with?
I don't remember.
Then that's how he got in. He had a duplicate made and then returned the original to the handbag.
Now, before you go any further with this, how did he get in through the street door?
Well, the street door is never locked.
I see. He could have had your key copied. And he could have used it to open the door. But of course he didn't.
Why not?
Because if he had, the key would still have been on him when he died. But no key was found when we went through his pockets.
Tony glances at Margot's handbag.
Oh, we seem to be back just where we started, don't we?
Well, not quite.
Well, then how did he get in?
We'd better get all this down on paper. I'd like you both to make an official statement before the inquest. My office is only a few moments from here. Perhaps you could come now.
Hubbard opens the door.
Tony.
Mark. Oh, Mark, this is Inspector Hubbard. Inspector, this is Mark Halliday. He was with me last night.
I'll do, Inspector.
Now, Mr. Halliday, as you were with Mr. Wendis last night, you may be able to help us here. Now, did you notice what time it was he went to the phone?
Well, yes, and it was just 3 minutes after 11.
Well, how did you come to notice that?
Well, Mr. Wendis' watch had stopped, and some of us compared times.
Now, thank you, sir. You see, it was when Mrs. Wendis came in here to answer his call that she was attacked.
Did you phone Margot before or after you phoned your boss?
Tony, I know what I wanted to ask you. Why did you telephone me last night?
Now, just one moment, before I lose the thread of this. Now, at 3 minutes past 11, you left your party to phone your boss.
Yes, I used the payphone in the lobby.
Now, how long were you on the telephone to your boss before you called your wife?
As a matter of fact, I never did speak to him. I couldn't remember his number in the country, so I rang my wife to ask her to look it up in the address book on the desk.
You mean you hauled me out of bed just to get his number?
I had to, darling. You see, my boss was flying to Brussels this morning. I wanted to remind him of something. It was rather important.
Wasn't there a telephone directory in the hotel?
Yes, but his country number wouldn't be in that directory.
Mm. And did you phone him?
Oh, no, naturally. When I heard what had happened here, I forgot all about it.
Mm. Yes. Well, Mr. Halliday, Mr. and Mrs. Wendis are coming to my office now to make their statements. Would you be good enough to give me your address, sir? I may want to get in touch with you.
Well, certainly.
I'll just get my coat.
I'm staying at the Carfax Hotel.
Just write it down there, will you? Your telephone number as well.
Right.
Hubbard hands Mark a notebook and a pencil, and he writes his address. Tony watches from the other side of the room.
Ever been over here before, sir?
Yes, about a year ago.
Mm.
There you are, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Wendis, there's quite a crowd in front of the house. I was going to suggest that we left by the garden. Isn't there a gate at the far end?
Yes.
Yes, I'm afraid the gate may be locked. Would you mind taking a look, sir?
Certainly.
Tony goes out through the French windows. Hubbard turns to Mark.
How much does he know about you and Mrs. Wendis?
I beg your pardon?
Well, you wrote a letter to Mrs. Wendis from New York. It was found in the dead man's inside pocket. I didn't mention it because I wasn't sure how much Mr. Wendis knew. Have you any idea how it got there?
No.
Margot returns wearing her coat.
Where's Tony?
He's just gone into the garden.
Mrs. Wendis, when you lost your handbag, did you lose a letter as well?
No.
Margot, it was found in the dead man's pocket.
You did lose it, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
I asked you that before, didn't I?
Yes. But you see, my husband didn't know about it.
Now, this man was blackmailing you, wasn't he?
It's no good, Margot. Tony will have to know about it.
No.
It's the only thing we can do, Inspector. After Mrs. Winters lost my letter, she received these two notes.
Mark hands them to the inspector. Tony reappears.
Last October. How many times have you seen this man?
I've never seen him.
Mr. Halliday, I'd like you to come along with us.
Yes, of course.
Mrs. Winters, when you come to make your statement, there may be other police officers present. I shall warn you first that anything you say will be taken down and may be used in evidence. Now, never mind what you've told me so far. We'll forget all about that. But from now on, tell us exactly what you know about this man and exactly what happened last night. If you try and conceal anything at all, it may put you in a very serious position.
I wish you'd explain what you mean by all this.
I will. Now, you admit that you killed this man. Well, you say you did it in self-defense. Unfortunately, there were no witnesses, so we've only your word for that.
But I heard it all, Inspector, over the telephone.
Well, what exactly did you hear, Mr. Winters?
Well, I heard a series of faint cries.
Well, did you hear anything to indicate that a struggle was going on?
What I did hear, Inspector, is perfectly consistent with what my wife told me.
So all you really know of the matter is what your wife told you, isn't it?
To Margot.
Now, you suggest that this man came to burgle your flat, but there's no evidence of that. There is evidence, however, that he was blackmailing you.
Blackmail?
Yes, I'm afraid that's true, Tony.
And you suggest that he came in by the window, and we know that he came in by that door.
But he can't have come in that way. That door was locked, and there are only two keys. My husband had his with him, and mine was in my handbag here.
She takes it out and shows them.
You could have let him in.
Are you suggesting she let him in herself?
Well, at present, that appears to be the only way he could have entered.
Don't you even believe I was attacked? How do you think I got these bruises on my throat?
You could have caused those bruises yourself. A silk stocking was found outside the window. It had two knots tied in it. Does that mean anything to you?
I suppose it must have been the stocking he used.
We found the twin stocking hidden underneath this blotting pad. Can you explain why your attacker should do that?
No.
Those stockings were yours, weren't they?
No.
We know they were. One of the heels had been darned with some silk that didn't quite match. We found a reel of that silk in your mending basket.
She opens the basket.
Tony, there was a pair of stockings here.
Tony crosses to the phone.
I've heard of the police deliberately planting clues to ensure a conviction.
His men were here for hours last night. They could easily have taken those stockings and done anything with them.
Of course they did. Probably wiped his shoes in the doormat as well. Oh, hello, Roger. Thank heaven you're in. Tony Winters here. Now, listen, we had a burglary last night and Margot was attacked.
Margot? Was she hurt?
No, she's all right, but the man was killed. The police are here now. And don't laugh. They're suggesting that Margot killed him intentionally.
I wouldn't say that about you, sir.
Well, that's a good one.
Yes, it is funny, isn't it? Now, Roger, could you come around at once, Maidervale Police Station?
Yes, be there right away.
Oh, thanks, old boy. Goodbye. It's all right, darling. Roger's going to meet us at the police station.
Mr. Winters, I should advise you.
Our lawyer will give us any advice we need, thank you.
Mark picks up Margot's bag.
Margot. Here's your handbag.
Thank you.
They go out.
You are coming, sir.
Oh, but of course, Inspector.
Yes, but I just wondered.
Hubbard leaves. Tony neatly straightens the rug before following him out through the French windows. Margot faces the court.
I charge you that on the 26th of September you did willfully murder Charles Alexander Swan. Do you wish to say anything in answer to this charge?
Looking stunned, Margot shakes her head.
And did you, at any time in your life, meet this man Swan?
She shakes her head again.
You received a letter from Mr. Halliday. This letter was found in the dead man's pocket. Now you say you did not know.
Do you find the prisoner, Margot Mary Winters, guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
A symbolic black cloth is placed on the judge's head.
The sentence of this court is that you be taken to the place from whence you came, from thence to a place of lawful execution.
A taxi approaches the house in Maida Vale. Sitting in the back seat, Mark sees Tony opening the front door of the house and going inside. Tony comes into the flat and closes the door. He switches on the light and takes off his raincoat. He carries his blue attaché case into the bedroom and puts it on the bed, which has been stripped to the mattress. Mark walks along the hall and rings the doorbell. Tony quickly covers the attaché case with a blanket and goes to open the door.
Oh, hello, Mark.
Tony. Hi.
Mark shows surprise at seeing a single bed set up in the sitting room.
Have you gotten any news from the Home Secretary?
Tony takes a folded piece of paper from his pocket and hands it to Mark, who reads it with concern.
Then it's tomorrow. Tony, I take it you'd do anything to save her life.
We've done everything.
No, Tony, we haven't done everything. I've been trying to figure out something for weeks just in case it came to this. Now I really believe it's her only chance.
Let's have it.
Margot was convicted because nobody believed her story. The prosecution made out she was telling one lie after another, and the jury believed him. But what did his case really amount to? Just three things. My letter, her stocking, and the fact that because no key was found on Swan, she must have let him in herself.
Don't try and tell me.
Wait a minute, Tony. Now, hear me out. This is where you come in. Now, you've got to go to the police and tell them some story. Anything that will convince them that Margot wasn't lying after all.
The police aren't likely to believe anything I might tell them.
Tony, I've been writing this stuff for years. I figured out something for you to tell them. Now, let's take those points one by one. Margot says she never let Swan in through this door.
He opens it.
Okay. He must have opened it somehow. Suppose you tell the police that you left your key out here somewhere.
He looks around the hall.
Then Swan could have let himself in.
How do you know it was there?
You told him.
But I haven't met Swan in 20 years.
Mark closes the door.
Tony, Swan is dead. Now, we've got to make the most of that. You can tell any story you like about him now. You can even say that, well, you two met somewhere and you planned this whole thing together.
Planned what? You suggesting I arranged for Swan to come here that night to blackmail her?
No. To kill her.
Kill Margot?
That's it.
Why?
Because she said so. He came from behind the curtain and he tried to strangle me. Okay, that's what he did. All you've got to do is support everything she said. Don't you see, Tony, that's my whole idea.
But what about your letter? A man doesn't try and kill the person he's blackmailing. It doesn't make sense.
Yes, I know. That worried me for a while, too, but I've got that linked. You tell them that you stole her handbag yourself.
Why should I do that?
Because you wanted to read my letter. And when you had read it, you got mad and decided to teach her a lesson. So you wrote those blackmail notes. Nobody can prove you didn't. And you can also say you never saw Swan at Victoria Station. You just invented that to try to connect him with my letter. Don't you see, Tony, how it all hangs together?
But your letter was found in his pocket.
Well, you put it there.
When?
But sometime before the police arrive.
Mark walks thoughtfully to the desk.
And you could have also planted the stockings at the same time.
But, Mark, why should I want anyone to kill Margot?
I know, Tony. That's tough for us to see because we both love her. But we need a reason now. We need it badly. Let's take one of the old stock motives. Had Margot made a will?
Yes, I believe she had.
Who's the beneficiary?
Why, I am, I suppose.
There's your reason, Tony.
But thousands of husbands and wives would leave money to each other without murdering each other. The police wouldn't believe a word of it. They'd take it for exactly what it is. A man trying desperately to save his wife.
Well, I certainly think it's worth that try. Let's face it, they can't hang you for a murder that never came off. Most you'd get to be a few years in prison.
Thanks very much.
It's a small price to pay, Tony. You'd be saving her life.
That's fine, coming from you, Mark. Her life wouldn't be in danger at all if it hadn't been for you. It's because of her association with you that she lost the sympathy of the jury. Don't get me wrong, Mark. If there was the slightest chance of this coming off, of course I'd do it. But it's got to be convincing. For instance, how could I possibly have persuaded Swan to do a thing like this?
Well, you offered him money or something.
What money? I don't have any.
Yes, you'd have had Margot's.
It'll be months before I get my hands on that. And people don't commit murder on credit. Oh, I'm afraid you'll have to think of something better than that. I know you're trying to help, but can you imagine anyone believing a story like that?
Yes, I can. If you make them believe it.
But I wouldn't know what to say. You'd have to come with me.
Oh, Tony, that'd really be a mistake. They know the kind of stuff I write. We wouldn't stand a chance then.
They both freeze. Mark grabs his hat as Tony opens the door.
Oh, hello, Inspector.
Mark hides in the bedroom. Hubbard enters the flat.
Is it about my wife?
No, sir, I'm afraid not.
Then what is it?
Well, I'm making inquiries in connection with a robbery that took place about 3 weeks ago, sir.
Well, can't it wait a few days?
Of course, sir, I'm very conscious of your position. If I may, I'd like to say how deeply sorry I am.
Yes, Inspector, yes, all right. Now, how can I help you?
Well, the cashier of a factory in Ledbury Street was attacked in his office, and two men made off with several hundred pounds, mostly in pound notes.
What has all this to do with me?
Well, in cases like this, all police divisions are asked to keep a lookout for anyone spending large sums of money.
I see.
And I was wondering if you'd sold anything recently for cash.
Why?
Well, my sergeant happened to be making inquiries at Wales's garage the other day, and it appears that you settled an account there recently for just over £60.
Yes, well, you see, I happened to have quite a bit on me at the time, so I settled for cash.
I see. Had you just drawn this money from your bank?
Have you been to my bank, Inspector?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I have. Yeah, but they wouldn't help me. Oh, bank statements are always jealously guarded.
Yes, well, I'm rather surprised you didn't come to me first.
It was only a routine matter. After all, I didn't want to disturb you.
Tony sits.
Where did you get it, sir?
Is that any of your business?
Well, if it was stolen money, yes, sir, it is my business. But do you mind if I smoke?
Go ahead. Do you really think I've been receiving stolen money?
Well, until you tell me where you got it, I shan't know what to think, shall I? You see, if you got this money from someone you didn't know, I mean, that might be the very person we're looking for.
He pretends to find a key.
Hello. This is yours, sir.
What is it?
Somebody's latchkey. It was lying on the floor just here.
Tony picks up his raincoat.
No, mine's here.
Hubbard tries the key in the lock.
No, it's not yours. It may be mine, then.
He searches his own raincoat pocket.
Yes, it is mine. Yes, it must have dropped out of the pocket. There's a small hole there. That's the trouble with these latchkeys. They're all alike. Oh, I'm sorry, sir, you were saying...
I don't think I was, is I?
Oh, yes, it's about that money. Yes, I'd be grateful if you'd tell me where you got it. After all, £100 is quite a lot to carry around.
You said 60 a moment ago.
Did I? Oh, yes. Yes, my sergeant decided to dig a little deeper before he put in his report. He said that you also paid a bill at your tailor's and another for wines and spirits.
Well, I'm sorry he went to all that trouble. Had he come straight to me, I could have explained it at once. I simply won rather a large sum at dog racing.
What, over £100?
Yes, over £100. It has been done before, you know.
Yes, well, why didn't you tell me this straight away, sir?
Well, I was rather ashamed of being caught going to dog racing when my wife was under sentence of death.
Yes, I know how it is. It helps to take your mind off things. Well, that answers everything, doesn't it? I'm sorry to have had to bother you at this time.
Oh, not at all, Inspector, not at all.
Mark is listening at the bedroom door. Hubbard goes to leave.
Oh, there's just one other thing, sir. Have you a small blue attaché case?
Don't say you found it already.
Why, have you lost it?
Yes, I was going to report it this afternoon. I think I left it in a taxi.
Mark spots it on the bed.
Well, we must try and get it back, mustn't we? Where did you pick the taxi up, sir?
Hyde Park Corner, about half an hour ago.
Anything valuable?
No, a few books and...
Any money?
£2 or £3 in an envelope, I believe.
Not £200 or £300?
No, I'm afraid not.
Just as well.
Tell me, Inspector, how did you find out about the attaché case?
Well, the wine shop mentioned that you had it when you paid your bill, so my sergeant checked back on your garage and your tailor. They both remembered you having it with you when you paid them.
Yes, well, I used it instead of a briefcase, you see. Mm.
Well, these taxi men are pretty good at turning things in. I hope you'll find it all right, sir.
Mark has prized open the attaché case.
Inspector, before you go, I think Mr. Wenders has something to tell you.
Oh, has he?
Then I'd like to show you something in here, sir.
Hubbard puts down his raincoat. He crosses to the bedroom. The attaché case is full of pound notes.
No wonder you couldn't bear to sleep in her bedroom.
There must be over £500 here.
He looks at Tony.
Where did you get it?
Well, I can tell you why he got it. This money was to have been paid to a man named Swan after he murdered Mrs. Wenders. But as you know, there was an accident, so it wasn't necessary to pay Swan after all. Obviously, he couldn't produce all this without questions being asked, so he lived on it. He's been living on it since the 27th of March.
Well, Mr. Wenders?
Before you came, Inspector, he was trying to persuade me to go to the police with the most fantastic story you ever heard. Apparently, I bribed Swan to murder my wife so that... correct me if I go wrong, Mark. So that I could inherit all her money. And that isn't all. You remember Mr. Halliday's letter? Well, apparently Swan didn't steal it. I did. And I wrote those two blackmail notes, and I kept Mr. Halliday's letter and planted it on the body.
And the stocking, which...
Oh, yes, the stocking. Perhaps I'd better tell this, Mark. It might sound more like a confession. I substituted... Is that the right word? Yes, I substituted my wife's other stocking for the one that... you do follow me, don't you? What else, Mark?
He told Swan he'd hide his key somewhere out here. Probably up on this ledge.
Mark checks the doorframe.
Swan let himself in. He hid behind the curtains. Then Wendis telephoned from the hotel. That brought her...
Just one moment. If Swan had used Mr. Wendis's key, it would still have been on him when he died. Besides, how did Mr. Wendis get in when he returned from the hotel?
Well, she could have let him in. And he could have taken his key from Swan's pocket before the police got here.
Could he let himself in with his own key? That came out in the trial. Don't you remember?
Come on, Mark. Your move.
Mark goes into the hall.
Swan could have taken the key down from here, unlocked the door, and then replaced the key on the ledge before he came in.
All right, Mr. Halliday, this is all very interesting, but it isn't getting me any nearer what I came to find out.
But this is a question of life and death. What else matters?
What matters to me is where Mr. Wendis got this money. That's all I want to know.
Hubbard opens a desk drawer. He removes a bundle of papers. Mark tries to grab it.
Just a moment, please.
Mark looks over his shoulder, then grabs a checkbook.
Inspector Williams, look at this. The last check he wrote was on the 26th of March. That's the day before this all happened. I tell you, he's been living off it ever since. Mrs. Banks...
Sorry.
Hubbard sits and reads a bank statement.
Well, he hasn't drawn any large sums from his bank, nothing over £53.
Mark checks the other statements.
But look, Inspector. Practically every week. £35, £40, £45, £50. He could have saved it up.
Of course, I could have been planning all this for years.
Then where did you get it?
Do you really want to know? I warn you, you won't like it, Mark.
Come on.
All right, you asked for it. When she called me back from the party that night, I found her kneeling beside Swan's body, going through his pockets. She kept saying he had something of hers, but she couldn't find it. She was almost hysterical. That's why I wouldn't let the police question her. In the state she was in, she'd have told every lie under the sun. The next morning, she showed me the money, just as it is now, all in £1 notes. And she said, if anything happens to me, don't let them find this. Well, after she was arrested, I took the money in that case to Charing Cross Station and left it in the check room. Whenever I needed money, I took it out and left it in some other check room. I knew if you found it, you wouldn't stand a chance. You see, she was just about to give it to him when she killed him instead. You don't expect anyone to believe this, do you?
Not really, no idea. What about it, Inspector?
Well, I must say I suspected something like that.
You mean you're not even going to check up on this? She's being hanged tomorrow.
Look, all this has been out of my hands for months. There's been a trial and an appeal.
Oh, of course, it wouldn't mean much to you, would it? You'd have to admit you arrested the wrong person.
I think you'd better go.
You bet I'll go.
As Tony opens the door, Mark confronts him.
But you've made one mistake. What'll happen when Margot hears about this?
Well, she'll deny it, of course.
And perhaps she'll change her will. You'll have done it all for nothing, Tony.
Mark leaves. Tony turns to Hubbard.
If I'd told that story of his, would anyone have believed me?
No, not a chance. Before nearly every execution, someone comes forward like this. This must have been very distressing for you, coming as it did.
You suppose they let him see her? I don't want her upset just now.
Have a word with your lawyer. He might be able to prevent it.
And I should get all that money into the bank before somebody pinches it.
Thank you. I think I will.
I hope Mr. Halliday's not waiting outside to see me. Would you mind just taking a look, sir, to make sure he's gone?
Tony turns and goes to look through the bedroom window. Hubbard picks up his raincoat and quickly swaps it for Tony's.
All clear?
Good.
Oh, by the way, sir, I was asked to tell you. There are a few things belonging to Mrs. Wendis at the police station.
What sort of things?
Oh, just some books and a handbag, I believe. They'd like you to come and collect them sometime.
You mean after tomorrow?
Yes, or today, if you like. Just ask the desk sergeant. He knows all about it.
Yes.
Well, goodbye, Mr. Wendis. I don't suppose we shall meet again.
Goodbye, Inspector, and thank you very much.
Hubbard leaves. Tony closes the door behind him. Hearing the street door close, he breathes a sigh of relief and pours himself a large whiskey. He drinks it quickly, then puts down the empty glass. He looks at his watch. Tony goes into the bedroom. He starts to fill his pockets with pound notes from the attaché case. Patting his pockets, he comes back into the sitting room, picks up the raincoat lying on the chair, turns off the light, and leaves the flat. Hubbard is hiding on the upper landing. As Tony leaves the house, Mark watches unseen from a corner of the street. Inside the house, Hubbard comes downstairs, still carrying Tony's raincoat. He searches one of the pockets and takes out a key. He tries the key in the door of the flat. The door opens and he goes inside. The curtains and shutters are closed, the room dark. Taking out a small flashlight, Hubbard crosses to the desk, puts down his briefcase and picks up the phone.
Give me Sergeant O'Brien, quick.
Right.
Hubbard, look, O'Brien, I've got back in again. Start the ball rolling.
Right.
Hubbard crosses to the door.
Inspector Hubbard. It's me, Mark Halliday.
Hubbard lets Mark in.
Now, what are you up to? What's the idea?
What are you doing here?
Never mind about that.
I was wondering why you didn't come.
You've got to get out of here, quick.
Listen, Inspector.
Shut up. If you want to save Mrs. Wendis, keep quiet and let me handle it.
How are you possibly going to...
Hearing the car horn, Hubbard indicates to Mark to be quiet. Then he goes quickly into the bedroom and walks across to the window. Carefully, he pulls aside the net curtain and looks out into the street. A car has drawn up outside and two men are getting out, followed by Margot. She stands on the pavement for a moment, speaking to the two men. Inspector Hubbard continues to watch her as she walks towards the house. Margot walks up the front steps, opening her handbag. The inspector returns to the sitting room. He stands expectantly beside the door as he hears Margot's footsteps in the hall. Hubbard shines his flashlight onto the lock, which does not turn. When Hubbard does not open the door, Mark stares at him in confusion. Hubbard goes back to the bedroom window. He sees Margot leave the house and run along the street towards the car. She speaks to the two men and they accompany her back along the pavement and past the house. Hubbard leaves the bedroom and goes back into the sitting room. He crosses towards the French windows.
But what is all this?
They talk about flat-footed policemen. May the saints protect us from the gifted amateur.
Hubbard opens the wooden shutters. The room is flooded with light.
You'd better prepare yourself for a surprise, Mr. Halliday.
Margot appears outside the French windows, her face pale and drawn. Seeing Hubbard, she turns to leave.
Margot.
She steps into the flat.
Hello, Mark. Where's Toby?
He's gone out.
When will he be back?
We're not sure. Was that you who rang just now?
Yes. Why didn't you let me in?
You've got a key. Why didn't you use it?
I did, but it didn't fit the lock.
No, and you know why, don't you?
No, I don't. Has the lock been changed?
May I have your bag a moment?
He opens the handbag and takes a key from her purse.
Whose key is this?
I thought it was mine. I don't know.
Mark looks puzzled as Hubbard goes into the bedroom.
What's going on here?
Hubbard returns, carrying the empty attaché case, and shows it to Margot.
Your husband's explained this, you know. You can tell us all about it now.
What is it? I don't understand.
No, I don't believe you do.
He calls into the garden.
Pearson?
Sir?
Take this handbag back to the police station and get that car out of the way.
Yes, sir.
Oh, wait a minute, you clot. You can't walk down the street like that. You'll be arrested. Put it in this.
His briefcase.
Margot, how did you get here?
I don't know. About an hour ago, the warden came to see me. He just said I was to be taken home. And then two detectives brought me here. And they said I could go. But I couldn't get that door in. Where's Tony? He was supposed to visit me this morning and they said he couldn't come.
Hubbard closes the shutters.
Has anything happened to him?
No. Nothing. Inspector, I don't want to interfere, but do you think you could tell us what you're up to?
Mrs. Wendis, what I've got to tell you may come as a shock.
Yes?
We strongly suspect that your husband had planned to murder you.
Tony arranged for Swan to come here that night and kill you.
How long have you known?
Did you suspect it yourself?
No, never. And yet... What's the matter with me, Mark? I don't seem able to feel anything. Shouldn't I break down or something?
It's delayed action, that's all. In a couple of days, you're going to have the most wonderful breakdown. What did you find out, sir?
Well, the first clue came quite by accident. We discovered that your husband had been spending a large number of pound notes all over the place. So it ran into over £300. And it appeared to have started at about the time you were arrested. Now, I had to find out where he got that money and how. And then I remembered that after you were arrested, we searched this flat. And I saw a copy of his bank statement in that desk. So yesterday afternoon, I went to the prison and asked to see your handbag. While I was doing this, I managed to lift your latchkey. Highly irregular, of course, but my blood was up. And then this morning, when your husband was out, I came back here to look at his statement. I never saw it, because I never got through that door. You see, the key that I'd taken from your handbag didn't fit the lock.
Hubbard quickly switches out the light and opens the door. He calls up the stairs.
Williams?
Wendis.
Closing the door, he goes into the bedroom and looks out of the window. Tony is approaching the house. As he reaches the steps, he searches the pockets of the raincoat he is carrying, but finds nothing. He feels in his jacket pockets and then his trousers. Looking puzzled, he checks the label on the raincoat, then turns and walks back along the street. Hubbard leaves the bedroom and crosses the dark sitting room. He walks to the desk and picks up the phone.
Oh, that was a near one.
Mandeville Police, O'Brien speaking.
Hubbard, look at Ron. He's found out about his raincoat. He just came back and couldn't get in. I think he's on his way to the station now. Has Pearson arrived with the handbag yet?
Yes, sir.
Good. Now listen. Give Wendis those books and the handbag and make sure he sees the key. Better make him check the contents and sign for them. If he wants his own key and raincoat, tell him I've gone to Glasgow.
Right, sir.
Any questions?
No questions.
Right, call me back when he leaves the station.
Roger.
In the hall, Mark searches the ledge over the door.
Well, Mr. Halliday, have you got it?
I don't think so. Where's Mrs. Wendis's key?
Hubbard takes the key from under the carpet on the fifth stair.
It took me just half an hour to find it.
He puts it back.
But if it was there, why didn't Wendis use it just now?
Well, he didn't use it because he doesn't realize it's there. He still thinks it's in his wife's handbag. You see, you were very nearly right. He told Swan that he would leave your latchkey under the stair carpet, Mrs. Wendis, and told him to return it to the same place when he left. But as Swan was killed, we naturally assumed that your key would still be in one of Swan's pockets. That was his little mistake, because Swan had done exactly as you suggested, Mr. Halliday. He unlocked the door, then returned the key before he came in.
And it's been out there ever since. And the key Wendis took out of Swan's pocket and returned to her handbag was
Swan's own latchkey. Mind you, even I didn't guess that at once. Extraordinary. You know, it had always puzzled me that no key was found on Swan's body. After all, most men carry a latchkey about with them. And then I had a brainwave. I took the key that was in your handbag to his girlfriend's, Mrs. Van Dorn's, and unlocked the door of her flat. And then I borrowed her telephone and called Scotland Yard.
Why did you bring me here?
Because you were the only other person who could possibly have left that key outside. I had to find out if you knew it was there.
Suppose I had known.
You didn't.
Margot sinks onto the bed.
Mark?
Yes, darling?
I think I'm going to have that key.
Hubbard picks up the phone.
Inspector Hubbard?
O'Brien?
Yes, he's just left the station.
Right.
Mark is comforting the weeping Margot.
Try and hang on just a little longer.
Hubbard calls up the stairs.
Williams? He's just left the station. Give me a thump if he comes this way.
What happens now?
Sooner or later, he'll come back here. As I've pinched his latchkey, he'll try the one in the handbag. When that doesn't fit, he'll realize his mistake, put two and two together, and look under the stair carpet.
But if he doesn't do that, all this is pure guesswork. We can't prove a thing.
That's perfectly true. But once he opens that door, we shall know everything.
What'll you do then?
I'm to phone the Home Secretary personally. He's standing by for a call now.
And Mrs. Wendis?
We'll have nothing else to fear.
All right, Mark.
Quiet now, you two.
Tony comes through the street door carrying some books and Margot's handbag. He takes a key from her purse and tries the door of the flat. The door does not open. He walks back along the hall. Hubbard goes into the bedroom as the front door closes. He looks out of the window. Tony has stopped just outside the house. Looking puzzled, he is turning the key over and over in his hand.
What's he doing?
He's wondering why that key doesn't fit. He's going round to the back entrance. He's stopped again. He's looking at the handbag now. He's trying to remember when he put the key back in there. No, he's given up. I'm afraid we've had it this time. He's going way down the street. Hold it. He's stopped again. He's turning round. He's staring at the key. Of course, that's Swan's key, isn't it? Now he's got it. He's coming back fast. He's remembered.
Tony comes back into the house and goes straight to the stairs. He takes the key from under the stair carpet. He puts the key into the lock and opens the door. He steps inside, putting down the books and bag. Inside the flat, Tony switches on the light. Mark and Margot and Inspector Hubbard stand facing him. He quickly opens the door. A detective stands outside. Tony slowly closes the door again. Distressed, Margot turns away. Tony shrugs, looks at the drinks on the sideboard, then walks calmly to the desk and picks up a bottle of whiskey.
As you said, Mark, it might work out on paper, but congratulations, Inspector. Oh, by the way...
He puts the key on the desk. Taking a glass from the sideboard, he pours himself a large drink.
Well, how about you, Margot?
Yes, I could do something.
Mark?
So can I. I suppose you're still on duty, Inspector.
Hubbard is dialing a number. Waiting for a reply, the inspector has a look of smug satisfaction as he combs his neat moustache. The end. The audio description was written and narrated by Di Langford and recorded at RNIB's Talking Book Studios. Alfred Hitchcock appeared in the bottom left-hand corner of the reunion dinner photograph.